Well, good evening and welcome. I'm Mark Bartlett, the head librarian of the Society Library, and it's great to see such a large crowd here this evening. And I'd like to welcome all of you and also welcome those of you who are watching this event over the internet. Our library has been recording our events over the last year, and we're creating a large catalog of them, which will be there for future generations of library members and the public. May I please ask all of you who have cell phones, beepers, pagers, laptops, to please turn them off and pack them away for the rest of the evening. We'd really appreciate it. The library does rely on the support of our donors to help make evenings like tonight possible. I want to thank all of the library members who helped support us during our annual appeal in 2008. And for those of you who did not have an opportunity last year, please know that we welcome contributions at any time during the year. This year, more than ever, the funds are really important to have evenings like tonight and all the rest of our programming. It's my pleasure to now invite a good friend of the library, Roger Pasquier, who's been a member since 1986, and he's a loyal member of our New York City Book Awards jury and the Development Committee, and he'll do our introduction to this evening's speaker.
Thanks, Mark. The New York, if you don't know, this library for many years has been giving prizes every year for the best books written about New York during the year. We have a jury that includes several writers and specialists in different topics that relate to New York. And you may not know that in the average year we have to look at about 200 books. There are that many books that are published about New York every year, academic, popular, fiction, poetry, and every aspect of human endeavor from prehistoric to today that New York has been the scene for. Our speaker tonight was the winner of last year's prize, and this year I want to remind you that our awards will be on Wednesday, May 6th. I won't tell you who's getting it because we haven't finished deciding. Some years it's very difficult to decide. But I want to ask you about another kind of jury, and I'm sure many of you have been on jury duty, and I wonder how many of you, like me, when you've been on jury, have hoped that you'd get on an interesting case and thought that if you were, you might write a book about it. And then you probably wondered why so few books have been written about the juror's experience. So when a friend of mine gave me for Christmas a trial by jury, which is Professor Burnett's second book, I was thrilled because this was somebody who was thinking exactly as I was and had much better luck than I to be on a much more interesting case, and he became the foreman, and he wrote about it. So in a few years after that, I saw Trying Leviathan by Graham Burnett on the monthly book list. I ran into the stacks to get it because I knew it would be terrific, whatever it was about. But imagine my surprise to discover that it was about another case. And this is, as you will hear more, a case that was tried in New York in 1818. And as you read the book, you feel as though Professor Burnett was actually there, but he also is omniscient. And the case, as you probably know, was about whether the whale is a fish. And this was an immediate economic issue in New York, but it also involved several other cultural and other orbits in New York at the time. It involved natural philosophers. As I learned from this book, the term scientist had not yet been coined. And among the natural philosophers, there was the split between the Linnaean school and the followers of Buffon, who had a very different idea of how animals should be classified. And it also pitted opinions between the natural philosophers and the people. And then there was also the distinction between the kind of patrician attitude of the time and popular culture. What is the role of experts in deciding whether something is true or not? And of course, inevitably, there was the question of religion. And of course, whalers needed to be brought into this case. And many of the issues foreshadowed Darwin, which makes it particularly interesting in the history of science. And finally, Professor Burnett showed why this trial could only have taken place in New York. In all of America, New York was the only place. So last year, the jury considered a number of history books, and I hope none of you were the authors of any of those, because they all paled in comparison with this one. And we were very impressed with the variety of sources that Professor Burnett used, that he read the jury records, of course, he looked at newspapers of the time, he read the advertisements, he read whaling logs. What did whalers think these creatures were? Of course, he had to consult the Bible and what were people thinking about the Bible in those days. He also had to look at what the encyclopedists had written and what their followers in English had written that was more accessible to people in New York at the time, as well as citing authors such as the inevitable Melville. So he produced an extraordinary book, which you will hear the substance about tonight. And last year, he won awards from the New Bedford Whaling Museum to the Los Angeles Times. But we hope it still meant something to him that the New York Society Library also gave him an award, because of all the cultural institutions that he cited as being active in 1818 in New York that played a role in how did people think about science. The library is the only one of those institutions that was already flourishing then and is still flourishing today. So, Graham, come up and talk.
Thank you very, very much. Such a pleasure to have a chance to be with you tonight. It absolutely meant an enormous amount to me to win the library's book award last year. So I just want to thank everyone who's involved in that decision. I don't know if there are readers of the New York Review of Books in the room, but the latest issue, the one that just came through the mail slot, has an ad from Princeton University Press listing all the books from the last year that won awards. And there is your award and my book because of you guys. So thank you very, very much again for that. So what I'd like to do over the next half hour or so is tell you a little bit about this book. And I'll do that under kind of three headings. I want to talk first just about the subject of the book. Then I'll talk a little bit about the structure of the book. And then finally I'll talk about the argument of the book. So to start off, what is Trying Leviathan about? It's the story of a trial where a set of jurors here in New York City were impaneled to decide, for the purposes of New York state law, whether a whale was a fish in 1818. So well might you ask how a question of natural order, of systematics, of taxonomy, found itself as a point of law. Okay? And let me resolve for you how that came to pass. Here is the Mayor's Court Register book from 1818, and I'll go ahead and read. James Maurice, plaintiff in this suit, complains of Samuel Judd, defendant in this suit, in custody and etc., of a plea that he rendered to the said plaintiff the sum of $75, lawful money of the state of New York, which to him he owes and from him unjustly detains, for the said defendant heretofore, to wit, on the first day of July in the year of our Lord 1818, at the city and in the county of New York, and after the 31st day of March 1818, did possess in the city of New York 3 casks of fish oil, the said 3 casks of fish oil not having been gauged, inspected, and branded according to law, contrary to the form of the statute in such a case. So for those of you who are thinking about becoming historians and how much fun it would be to sit in the archive all day and make your way through volumes and volumes of turgid legalese, you now have a little flavor. So what do we do with this? Okay, so what had happened? Early in 1818, the New York State Legislature passed a new law that required that fish oil sold in the state of New York was required to have been inspected, the casks gauged to determine the amount of oil in the cask, and a stamp placed on the cask certifying it as having been inspected. This was part of a new regime, and we'll talk a little bit more about where this regime comes from, but this was a kind of early commercial legislation ostensibly to protect buyers, so that you weren't getting adulterated oil. So one fine day, the inspector, James Maurice, wanders into the shop of a chandler, an outfitter of ships and vessels, named Samuel Judd, downtown, and inspects a couple of casks of oil,
about to leave. Because what about those three casts over there in the back? And Judd says, oh, those three casts. Don't worry about those three casts. Those aren't part of your job. Well, why aren't those part of my job? Those three casts contain spermaceti oil. And as you probably know, Mr. Maurice, having recently read the latest natural philosophy coming out of Paris, whales, spermaceti whales, sperm whales, are no longer considered fish by French philosophes. To which Maurice replied, oh yeah? Well, here in New York State, nobody's told me anything about enormous creatures that live all the time in the water, swim, cannot come out of the water, have fins. Nobody told me that they're not fish. So as far as I'm concerned, those are under my brief. If you don't let me inspect them, whack, I'm putting the cuffs on you, dragging you down to the station. So Judd indeed refuses to grant the inspector access to these barrels, and a test case is set up to determine exactly what is to be done with this question. Okay? So I want to talk a little bit about, before I kind of dig in on the structure of the argument, I want to set up a little bit where we are and why a case like this might matter. So I am, by trade, a historian of science. And historians of science, let's say you're a historian of science, and let's say you're wandering around the archives, and you should happen to stumble on the records of a case like this, it's like dying and going to heaven. And it's like dying going to heaven because historians of science are very interested in the ways that people at different times in the past have made sense of nature, what they thought about the way nature works. And yet that kind of thing is pretty hard to access, right? I mean, to get the views of different sorts of people about specific questions about natural order, you really have to think, what kinds of sources could I use to get access to that? And in a sense, textbooks, which are useful sources, almost never give you good windows into controversies. Textbooks, you know, the kind of works that are published once the controversies are over, usually give you a pretty tidy sense of everybody agreeing. They try to sound authoritative. And so historians of science get very excited, historians of all sorts get very excited when they can find records of controversies, because then you see the fissures open up. Not fissures like fish, right? Fissures like the cracks. You see these cracks open up in consensus. So the set of records for the case Maurice v. Judd promised from the moment I stumbled on them a kind of story about ideas of nature in the early republic that I thought hadn't been told in another way. At the same time, it's very much a story about New York City. And part of the larger stakes of the case demand that we sort of dig in for a moment in this map of the city published in 1819 and look first at this building, which probably is familiar to some of you. Can anybody identify that building?
That is City Hall, which had just recently been finished.
Exactly. And a building of which New Yorkers were enormously proud, okay? And it was in this building that the mayor's court was conducted. So the trial of Maurice v. Judd is happening right there in the new kind of acropolis of the city of New York. And here it is in City Hall Park, right in the center, okay? The other building I want us to be thinking about is the building that is the new, how to put it, it's sort of, if this is like the, if this is the new acropolis for the city, kind of politically, this is the new kind of philosophical centerpiece of New York City. This is the New York Institution for Learned and Scientific Societies, an organization which had been created right a few years before this trial goes down, and which was designed to bring together all of the men of learning in New York into a single kind of royal society type institution. The idea was going to be that New York, which had long been denigrated by the other cities of the early republic, Boston, Philadelphia, as a rough-hewn, mercenary, snake pit, getting and spending, mighty dollar, not a lot of thinking folks in New York City. You want polite culture, you want learning, where do you go? Philadelphia, you know, you have the American Philosophical Society, the great legacies of Franklin and so forth, or you go up to Boston, where again you have a long-standing, close link to England, Cambridge, Harvard, right? New York? No. Prominent New Yorkers, among them the founders of this institution, were keen to overturn that sort of, that rap that New York had at the time. And so they had banded together and taken over this institution, which was previously an almshouse, a kind of, a poorhouse. Many, many jokes about giving the philosophers, the men of science, the old almshouse to set up their little experimental laboratories and collections of rocks and stuffed animals and so forth. But at any rate, here they are. And where are they located? We'll zoom in here for a second. There's the City Hall building, right? Built 1803 to 1812, white marble. Here's that New York institution. And here they are, zoomed in on City Hall Park. Here's City Hall. Here's the New York Institution. They sit right next to each other. And the reason that's significant is that, in a sense, I want you to begin already to feel that the trial of Maurice V. Judd wasn't just a trial about whether whales were fish or not. It was also kind of a trial where, for the first time, a set of, let's say, expert witnesses walk that 75 feet from this brand spanking new institution of philosophical learning, a kind of royal society for a newly philosophically oriented United States. They walk over here to give expert testimony about what the men of learning in Europe say is the deal on the question of natural order. And we'll see how they fare in this quintessentially democratic agon of a jury trial. Okay, that's kind of the core issue of the trial. So to set that up now, you know, we have a sense, I hope, of what the subject of this book is and maybe a little bit about why it matters. Let me talk about how the book is structured. At one point in the course of the trial, one of the witnesses, actually it's a lawyer cross-examining one of the witnesses, says, we're interested here in whether whales are fish. There are a variety of people you might ask. You might ask a philosopher, he says, frankly, somewhat, in a slightly deprecatory tone. You might ask a philosopher about that question. But you might also ask a whaleman or a fisherman, somebody who really knew how to get his hands dirty with those animals. You might also ask a man of affairs, somebody who deals in oils and whale products, who should be expected to have a certain kind of market knowledge of this subject matter. And then finally, because this is a democracy, you might ask the people, right? An interesting question that Roger alluded to, the question of the sort of status of expert knowledge of men of learning in a democratic Republican government is a very new and very challenging question, not just in the United States at this moment, but also in France. Right? I mean, this is previously science had always been embedded with kings, basically. Right? It was the Royal Society this and the Royal Society that, and the Académie Royale with this, that, and the other thing. So the question of how these fancy guys with good-looking wigs and terrific we're going to fare in a democratic setting was an open question. Those four categories that that lawyer alludes to become, for me, the architecture of this book. So I want to understand, a little bit like, you know, the joke of the blind guys and the elephants, what each of those different groups knew about whales. Philosophers, ordinary New Yorkers, men of affairs, businessmen, and whalemen. Okay? And so the four chapters of this book are built around a kind of excavation of what each of these categories of folk brought to the forum of the trial. And before the book is out, you get to see how these different kinds of knowledge fare when they're set against each other and they have to fight it out. Okay, so that's the basic structure of the book. So what I thought I'd do is to give you a flavor of the book. I'll talk a little bit about each of those categories. So let's begin with ordinary New Yorkers. What did ordinary New Yorkers know about whales in 1818? And how would you, as a historian, go about trying to figure out the answer to that question? Well, we're in luck. Because, as it happens, if you're willing to do a lot of pretty boring archival research, you can discover that there were a couple of places in New York City where an ordinary New Yorker could go and check out some whale bits. And one of them is in the New York Institution, not surprisingly. Because in the New York Institution, here, City Hall, so this is a view of exactly what we've just seen, but taken from this corner, going this way. Okay? So imagine you're standing here, and you're looking this way. This is what you would see in 1818. City Hall, here on your right. And the New York Institution, the west end of that building. And I'm going to zoom in now for you on this period watercolor. And you can see American Museum written in on the end of that building. This was one of the first public institutions of kind of, if you like, didactic high culture, where provided you were dressed decently and looked like you weren't going to spit tobacco juice on the floor and had a quarter, you could come, go into the museum, and stuff. Some paintings. A visitor from Philadelphia complained that there was a little too much nudity in the Venetian prints in the print room. So it was kind of a, you know, there was a high-low thing going on here. But there was a very extensive collection of naturalia, of stuffed birds and stuffed quadrupeds and this sort of thing. And there was a bit of a whale. In a section of the book that I won't try to rehearse for you, I'm able to recover exactly when this whale was taken and how it was dragged to New York. And it is a pretty zany story because it was kind of an enterprising showman at the time who set up the whale's jaw on Lower Broadway with a pseudo-Italian band playing oompa music and invited people again for the low price of, in this case, 50 cents initially. The whale jaw started to get a little icky, and then he had to drop the price, to pay to dance to the Italian oompa music underneath the great jaw of a huge whale, because it was just such a kind of crazed, diabolical, frenetic thing to imagine. The ad in the newspapers read, you know, never before in the new world or the old has an occasion for entertainment like this been provided. And as I was reading, I was like, probably right, actually. Quite possible that never has happened. He cleaned it up later, took it upstate when it got too bad for, it's kind of the standard story, but it was too stinky for a long, and he took it up to Albany for a while, and like, so he did it there. And eventually that jaw makes its way to this museum. And I was able to find a large broadsheet with the unique example of the broadsheet, which is in the New York Historical Society, which advertises the collection of naturalia. And I won't drag you through it, but if you're curious, it's kind of fun because you can get a kind of implicit sense of the idea of taxonomy from how these items are listed on that broadsheet. And so there's a category, quadruped, right? Quadruped, four-footed creature. You want to be thinking now, because exactly the moment when all this kind of stuff about mammal is just coming online, you all are like, think this is an incredibly funny story, because you all know that a whale is a mammal, right? And a whale is a mammal, except who came up with the idea of mammals anyway? Right? Doing history of science question.
1730s, 1740s. But he's very slow to move whales into it, for what it's worth. They are not the sort of standard mammal category.
And before we get to the end of this brief talk, you'll see why a lot of New Yorkers thought it was pretty icky, actually, to replace the category quadruped, a nice tight category, four-footed creature, with this new term, mammal, which has slightly different boundaries. You can see why, right?
There are some weird creatures like whales that don't have 4 feet, but aren't animals.
Thought it was kind of icky because what's the discriminant for mammals? Yes, here's someone who knows some French who reaches for her breast because she's already dismayed that I'm going this direction with this talk. She cannot believe, like a good New Yorker of 1815, she is concerned about the direction this is going to take. And New Yorkers were concerned because mammal comes from mammel, breast, and at a time when you couldn't even say ankle in mixed company, the idea that you could have like an entire category of nature that was like the gazangas, you know, kind of that, is just completely horrifying. It was just completely obscene. And that it was French, right? French philosophers who invented this category, basically, and who promulgated it, Trump. I mean, Linnaeus, of course, is Swede, but he, you know, he was promoting this category through the Jardin d'Etang, the primary institution for natural history, which was centrally Parisian at this time. Okay, so why am I saying all of this? Because a poor guy like John Scudder, who runs this museum, I mean, basically, he's in this to make a buck. He wants people to have a great time in this museum. He still wants them to feel like they're getting some science, so he tries to use these categories a little bit, but he uses them in some not entirely reliable ways. So he still uses quadruped, because he won't print mammal. You know, you don't want to alienate your audience. But in the category quadruped, in addition to a bunch of obvious quadruped-like things, bison, you know, wild cat, this sort of stuff, he includes seals. Now, seals, of course, don't have 4 feet, right? They got 2 feet, basically. Barely that. And you count their front flippers as feet, they got 2 feet. On the back, they got nothing to describe as a foot. So what you can see is that about 1818 in New York, a guy like Scudder, who's trying to sort of skim some natural history books to get an idea of how to organize his junk, already knows that the category quadruped is kind of on its way out, but it can't already go like all the whole mammal direction and like, right? So no. So his fish category includes a lot of stuff that we would not consider a fish, including a bunch of crabs, right? Which you immediately think, well, that's not a fish, it's a cetacean. It's like you picked butt in ninth grade biology, so you know that. And yet, of course, we do say shellfish, right? Which is a kind of etymological remnant of the fact that right up through the 19th century, in common parlance in English, fish was used to describe anything that came out of the sea. So a fishmonger was generally a lady who sold fish stuff, but you would certainly expect to be able to get mussels and clams from her, and you wouldn't say, you know, where's the crustacean monger? Doesn't happen. So it's not so weird that Scudder puts crabs and a bunch of other crustaceans under fish. He also puts a dolphin and a porpoise in there, which again, you know, are cetaceans and hence air-breathing things that do nurse their young, although you probably don't know how they nurse their young, because if you try to think about it for a second, this kind of does a little baby dolphin suckle milk underwater, right? I mean, it's like, you think it would get kind of lost in the transition, and but that's a different question. So, where's the whale go? That's where we're going with this. You're in Scudder's Museum. You're an ordinary New Yorker. You're learning about nature. You find the whale jaw. What category does Scudder list it under? It's under miscellaneous. It's under miscellaneous. It's under miscellaneous where it sits next to a model of the fortress of Saint-Cloud, entirely peopled by more than 200 small carved figures, some of which are mounted, all of which, including the castle and the figures, are carved entirely from beef bones. Okay? So it's just like an amazing doodad that Scudder happened to have. He's like, check it out. That's in miscellaneous. The whale jaw is in miscellaneous. And two tremendous hairballs weighing in at a total of 10 pounds removed from the stomach of a pig that lived on Spring Street. Okay? And so what's the miscellaneous category, and what can we learn from this as historians about the status of Wales in the early 19th century? So, you know, you're a historian, you're in the archive, you're trying to figure out what you can say in this chapter. You can basically say with some comfort that there was some confusion about Wales, generally speaking. And moreover, that really where they fit is under the category of amazing stuff. Weird stuff, right? So they're only like any, they're not fish, they're just weird. And they go with wonders. So that's the category that it turns out to be the relevant taxonomic grouping for the whales. Wonders. A residual category about which we could talk more if any of you were really fired up about history of science. The story of the erasure of the category of the wonder across the 17th into the 18th, and then finally by the early 19th century, is a very interesting story. You don't have scientists interested in wonders anymore by the 1850s. Such things don't exist. Anyway, moving on. What else can you learn about how ordinary New Yorkers thought about whales? Well, you can find some children's primers. This is a book that was on sale literally three blocks from the mayor's court in 1815. So let's say you wanted to buy your kid a little, you know, useful learning. You could buy The History of Fish. And as you will see from this frontispiece image, there's some kind of a horrible monster thing definitely spouting, which is the headliner for the Book of Fish. You also, of course, have some sort of turtle-like things that we would not consider fish. But the pull quote is the great whales. So, you know, you're generally seeing here that there's an entire category on whales in this book on fish. So New Yorkers are pretty much taking the orthodox line that whales, because they live in the sea, are fish. Okay. Into the teeth of that common knowledge, whales are pretty much fish, probably, but they are very strange. They're kind of amazing. Comes the work of this guy, Samuel Latham Mitchell. And Mitchell was indeed a member of this organization back in the day. He was the most distinguished American man of learning in this period. So sort of a little bit kind of post-Jefferson, but kind of pre-Joseph Henry, if you like. He was a medical doctor from Long Island. He was the member of 50 different scientific associations in Europe. He had done his education in Edinburgh and spent time on the continent. And he taught at the forerunner institutions of both Columbia and NYU. And he taught chemistry. He taught natural history. He taught materia medica and anatomy and a host of other topics. This is actually a student doodle in the margins of a student notebook from the period. So this is the kind of lesson I warn my students when I give versions of this talk. Beware what caricatures you draw in the margins, because they will be the stuff of future histories. And you can see here that he was depicted as a rather portly character and possibly slightly ponderous. And that's basically right. And he was the main guy to take that short walk from the New York institution, where he was the reigning capo di tutti capi, to the court to hold forth on the anatomy and taxonomy of God's creatures. And this gives you a sense of the kind of issue that he was pushing. He was pushing American sophistication in the sciences, and he was demanding that Americans come on board with the latest thing in Europe, which was comparative anatomy. What's comparative anatomy? Comparative anatomy is the business of making taxonomic discriminations, not based on superficial external characteristics of creatures, like four-footedness, but on deep internal physiological characteristics, like whether they breathe air or nurse their young. We now think that that kind of comparative anatomy project is a lot better for organizing stuff. And we now have evolutionary explanations for why that should be the case, that you get at a deeper truth about family resemblances when you look at fundamental physiological systems as opposed to external superficial characteristics. But this was news in the late 18th century, because the most popular taxonomic system in existence at this time was Linnaean botany, which any kind of amateur botanists in the room, people who love plants and that sort of stuff. Oh, God. You guys, I just love history of science. I wish I could just take you all, throw you on a bus, bring you down, teach my history of science course. If you would have a hugely fun time. Linnaean botany in the late 18th century is a system for organizing plants that works entirely on counting the pistils and stamens in the centers of the flowers of the flowering plants. Okay? This too actually got people into a lot of trouble because, as you may know, those are the sexually reproductive parts of the plant. And Linnaeus himself kind of riffed on this by giving the names to the taxons of different sort of like non-standard domestic arrangements. So let's say you have three pistils and one stamen. He would give that a name in Latin that was the equivalent of like three wives and one husband. For which reason, right into the early 19th century, botany was understood to be an unacceptable field of study for women. Any of you who've read Mary Wollstonecraft's remarkable Vindication of the Rights of Women might have noticed the little passage where she's like, you know, and how about this business about how women can't study botany because you guys think we're all going to be perverted by knowing that there are a couple of situations in nature where there are like two male parts and one female part to a plant or vice versa. So, it's to say that that system, which was purely combinatorial, worked really well for plants, didn't work so well for animals. People tried it, count the teeth, count the fingernails, this kind of stuff, but you don't get especially tidy categories when you do that with animals. And Mitchell wanted people to realize that what you got to do is dig into the body. You got to cut the body open. When you cut the body open, what do you notice about a dolphin? That it looks exactly like a sheep, basically, and it looks nothing like a fish, right? But to see that, you got to get inside it. So here he is, pitching New Yorkers in a very energetic, democratic way on this idea. This is a broadsheet circular. Imagine a time in New York where you could be walking down Broadway and see somebody pasted something like this up on a lamppost, okay? Anatomy is the basis of improved zoology. The classification of animals is founded upon their organization. This can be ascertained only by dissection. The use of the knife is recommended for the purpose of acquiring acquaintance with the structure of animals. Thus, all citizens ought to avail themselves of all opportunities to cultivate comparative anatomy and to communicate the results of their labors and researches to the society. Now, he takes the stand, Mitchell does, and he confronts one of the great characters of the early 19th century, a more or less totally irresponsible Irish Jacobin lawyer who is the Whales of Fish, as far as I know, lawyer, James Maurice's lawyer, and who proceeds to make mincemeat of just about everybody on the stand, although Mitchell can hold his own. And what does Mitchell say from the witness stand? As a man of science, I can say positively that a whale is no more a fish than a man, and nobody pretends to the contrary nowadays but lawyers and politicians. Okay? So, he means this pretty seriously. And he means it seriously in a way that is going to prove extremely disorienting later on in the trial. Because what he means is, human beings and whales are both mammals. So in that sense, he means this literally. A whale's no more fish than a man is a fish. Right? Because whales and human beings belong in the same category. And it is this idea that sets the crowd, the courtroom is packed for this trial, because it is the weirdest question anybody has ever imagined seeing in a court of law. There's no television. There's barely any theater. This is, you know, kind of high popular entertainment. So the galleries are packed to see these guys go at it, and you can imagine how they hiss and whistle at a moment like this. Especially because, and I didn't say this perhaps so clearly, the basic taxonomy of ordinary New Yorkers at this time is drawn directly from the genus. There are three categories. There are beasts that crawl on the land. There are fish that swim in the sea. And there are birds that fly in the air. Right? That's what Genesis says explicitly. And that's a great categorization, metaphysically speaking, because human beings don't fit. They're an end of one. Right? We don't creep. We're not on all fours. We're not quadrupeds. We're two-legged like birds, but we don't fly. And so human beings are like this special category, godlike, right? And you can see how that's a very nice shape to things. Organize animals into three categories, but human beings don't fit into any of them. One of the scary things about the project of the growth of the Linnaean systematics and taxonomy, that it was going to eat human beings. Right? It was going to bring human beings into the animal kingdom. And even so profoundly important a naturalist as Georges Cuvier could resist including human beings in the category of mammal into the early 19th century. He resisted putting human beings in the category of mammals into the early 19th century. Now, to give you some sense of the stakes here, I just thought to tell you quickly where we are in the talk so you don't give up hope, right? We've done ordinary New Yorkers and their sort of vision of things. We've glossed a little bit what the naturalists are thinking at this time by talking about Mitchell. And we're going to do the whalemen and the men of affairs before we're done, so we're cresting past the halfway point. I want to give you a sense, though, before we leave the men of learning, the proto-scientists, of the stakes. And this is one of the other lawyers, well, together, Samson, the irresponsible Irish Jacobin. I should say it's impossible not to love him, but he does kind of play the populist card in ways that are a little disorienting before the case is over. Here's Samson and Anton making fun of Mitchell, and in effect saying to that Democratic gallery, be careful, because if you let these guys from the New York Institution of Learning come into the City Hall and lecture us about how to categorize living things, are you ready for the implications? Here we go. We have a statute, one of the lawyers says, which declares that every free man shall be entitled to a vote at our public elections. Let us suppose, then, that at some one of those arduous struggles where everything in the shape of a man had been by the zeal of politicians urged to the hustings, that the learned doctor here, Mitchell, had appeared, leading forward with all due gravity to the polls, an orangutan, or man of the woods. Would that stranger's vote be received, although the doctor should very learnedly and eloquently urge his claims, as he has done those of the whale on the present occasion? He breathes the vital air, the doctor might say, through lungs. He moves erect and has warm blood. The female brings forth her young alive and rears the bantling at her breasts. The inspectors would say, in reply to the eloquence and learning of the doctor, as we do in the case of the whale, oh, this is indeed very strange and curious. But still, doctor, it is a monkey in common acceptation, however naturalists may choose to hail and class him as a brother. So there's, you know, I can hear a few people laughing, which is reasonable because this is a joke, but a few people are not laughing, and those of you who are not laughing are probably seeing the extremely ugly rolling of the shoulders of race in this passage. What are these lawyers saying? Let Mitchell tell you about whales and fish? What's to stop him from coming in here next week and saying, actually, you know, black people are human beings also. And the way I read the Constitution, you know, I'm saying that these people deserve full recognition. This is in a period where the question of the free black franchise in New York is probably the most explosive electoral issue in the city. There was considerable violence in the immediately precedent election concerning which way the small but significant number of free blacks would vote if they were allowed to vote in that election. So what I want you to see here is that part of what people are wrestling with is the status of expert knowledge in democracy. And they're, you know, in a sense saying, you come over here into City Hall, and in City Hall, we're going to determine things democratically. We don't take expert opinion here. It's the kind of decision of the people. Okay, let me spend, because I want to make sure we leave time for questions. Let me spend a moment on what is in part, you know, really just my favorite part of the book, which is where you dig in and try to figure out what whalemen knew about whales. A guy like Mitchell had read a lot of books, many of them in Latin, written by European savants, but he had spent exactly 0 hours and 0 minutes standing up to his waist in the viscera of a huge whale. Okay? Whereas folks out in Sag Harbor and in New Bedford and then Nantucket had spent very considerable chunks of their life going nose to nose with animals like this. And so what I wanted to do in this section of the book was kind of frame this remarkable moment in the trial where two whalemen give testimony and, interestingly, disagree. There's a captain of the vessel who says, I'm no ignoramus. I have read encyclopedias, I'll have you know, and I know very well that the whale is not a fish. Some common sailors call them fish, but people who are properly schooled in the ways of the world understand these things a little better. And then they call in an ordinary whaleman in a kind of dramatic gesture, actually pulling him right out of the gallery. There's a guy in a peacoat in the gallery. They're like, hey, you, come down. And he says, as far as I know, they're fish. We always called them fish. And this whole business about how they have to come up and breathe air, well, let me tell you about this one time when I was sitting there, we chased this thing, we chased it for hours, and then suddenly it went down, and it never came back up. So I don't think they have to come up, because if it had come up, we'd have seen it. We sat there for 17 hours, and the thing never came up. So, you know, Mitchell here may say that they have to, like, come up to the surface to breathe air, but in my personal experience, they do not have to breathe air, always. Maybe sometimes they do, but... And anyway, the stuff that spouts out of them, which Mitchell's never really seen, I think it's water. Have you ever seen a whale spout? It is kind of... It's kind of hard to tell what it is. It's like bizarre, steamy stuff. It could be water, right? So you get these kinds of arguments that are happening in the trial. To sort of contextualize that, I spent a number of weeks in these collections of logbooks up in New England, trying in a sense to read these logbooks for sort of vernacular ideas, like lay ideas about anatomy, physiology, taxonomy. And I won't bore you with this, but suffice it to say that I found a lot of very interesting stuff. This is a sketch done by a whaleman in the back of his logbook. It's a specific, big, huge whale that they had killed. And interestingly, he actually says that this, which looks to you and me like a lance or a harpoon, he says, you notice that it's got a number on it, number 11? This has a key, and in the key, he says, that thing that looks like a lance is actually a pointer where I'm indicating for you the life of the whale. The life of the whale was the site that whalers tried to hit, basically right behind the back part of the skull, which reaches all the way here, and where you get the sweet meat below the spine to go into the heart and lung cavity of the animal. So, my point is that these guys had a kind of an implicit idea about physiology, which they mapped onto the external, superficial envelope of the animal. And they had a quite sophisticated implicit taxonomy, anatomy as well. So you may notice here that there are some lines carved on this head. Those are the kind of rudiments of what's called a cutting-in diagram, which was the pattern used by whalers to strip the animal of its blubber. Moby Dick lovers in the audience know that this fishery in the 19th century proceeded by going out to kill the animal. The animal you bring alongside to the, I see someone who's doing the like thing, who knows how it works. You peel it like an orange. You bring it alongside the vessel. You put a hook into the blubber. You make a couple of cuts to begin to separate the blubber from the underlying musculature. And then you winch. And the animal rolls in the water, and a strip of blubber is peeled off going around and around. You have two guys who do different knives to kind of continue to cut along. And it turns out that whalemen spent a lot of time arguing about the best way to make those cuts to strip the animal most completely. And I found this extensive tradition of sort of, it's not the anatomy of a French philosopher, but it's a quite sophisticated anatomy nevertheless, kind of practical or craft anatomy. This is perhaps my favorite. This is a little model of pedagogical tool that was carved by a 19th century American whaler for the purpose of doing instruction on the vessel with young guys. You sort of, it unscrews, in a sense, to show how the strips should come out. And these are how you divide the head and the different bits for processing. In these same documents, you see that whalemen were probably reading popular natural histories at the time and doing their own versions of sort of taxonomy. Here are a bunch of different cetacean types laid out pretty much the way you would have seen it in a popular natural history book at the time, although with the interesting addition that the whaleman has depicted them all spouting blood, which is sort of the way a whaleman always likes to see his whales, right? You know, you want to see their lungs nice and punctured so that they're jetting thick blood. maybe the most telling source on the ambivalence that Whaleman felt is this. I found the manuscript speech given by a 19th century whaleman about the natural history of whales, a presentation given in a kind of popular setting in New Bedford. And in his manuscript copy, you can see here that he has himself written in whale, W-H-A-L-E, and then crossed it out and put fish up above. So speaks volumes, in a sense, to the interchangeability of these categories for a guy like this. There's some other stuff that comes out in the course of this research, which is sort of odd, including that whalemen didn't even call all whales whales. They reserved the term whale for the two species that were huntable, which were, does anybody know? Again, I'm a little gifted here. Sperm whales, and basically, fin whales, blue whales, all those kinds of things? No. You know why? Just too fast. The mothers are so fast that you couldn't row after them and catch them. And if you did, and you managed to get a spear in one of them, they're so dense, they have so little blubber in relation to their musculature, that they sink. So if you didn't kill it, you basically lose it. So these guys, you find in their notebooks, oh, blue, you know, we see sulfur bottom after sulfur bottom after sulfur bottom, the 19th century term for a blue whale, no whales, which to modern readers is totally incoherent. Blue whale, blue whale, blue whale, but no whales, right? Indicating, again, that the kind of taxonomy of the whalemen was a thing unto itself. Okay, finally, the men of affairs. Some of you are probably wondering if I'm going to just tell you what happened at the end of this trial now, but of course I'm not. You do know that, right? I'm not going to tell you that, because I've learned my lesson with that. Nobody will buy and read this book if I tell you what happened, so you'll have to tie me down and do horrible things to me here in the august halls of the New York Society Library to get me to reveal the upshot of this case, so forget it. But I will give you I will reveal a critical clue to what happened, which is that it is in this chapter on the men of affairs, the chandlers and the merchants of oil, that we reveal that this is not really, as it might have appeared from that first slide where I described how Maurice and Judd like kind of had a little argument and so then the guy gets dragged into court. It's not like a little commercial transaction gone awry. But this is in fact a formal test case, which is being joined by two of the most powerful factions in the city of New York at the time, who are really combating over something like control of the New York State Legislature. Those two factions are the chandlers, guys like the oil merchant Thomas Hazard, here giving testimony, saying, are you kidding me? Look, I don't know anything about whales, this guy says, right? He's a buddy of Judd's. I don't know anything about whales, but it doesn't matter. Because the law is about fish oil. And what I'm telling you is that fish oil and whale oil are not the same commercial product, regardless of what whales are. You know, I'm not a philosopher. It makes no difference to me what a whale is. He says, the distinction between meal and flour is not more known than that between whale and fish oil, or between wheat and buckwheat. If anyone were to order fish oil and I were to answer by sending him whale oil, it would be the same as if he'd ordered sugar and I'd send molasses, right? So obviously, the guy shouldn't have to pay the inspection fee on spermaceti oil under the fish oil statute. Now, the other faction is the oldest and, in a sense, most powerful political, what do you want to call them? They're not really a mafia, but they're a kind of a cohort of guys who knew how to strong-arm urban politics in New York City, the Tanners. It's not likely to be known to any of you except specialists in New York history, but New York was at one time basically the tanning capital of the world because of the enormous forests of hemlock and oak trees in upstate New York, which were the main source of tanning, the primary expensive ingredient in tanning processes. And there were a set of very powerful tanners who kind of ran the equivalent of the Five Points District downtown in the day. And this guy, Gideon Lee, who would shortly after this trial become mayor, was the biggest, meanest, toughest tanner of them all. And as it happens, he was the guy who wrote the fish oil inspection statute. Thank you very much. Early lobbying effort through his friends in the state legislature. And he was trying to vertically integrate his business. Who uses fish oil? Tanners. Because after you've tanned a piece of leather, I don't know, probably none of you has ever tried to do this, but after you soak a piece of disgusting skin in a nasty, like, swamp water of old oak leaves for a half a year or so, take it out and dry it, it is as stiff as a piece of plywood. And then what you have to do is steep it in oils in order, again, to make it supple like a piece of leather. So here's the tanner king, Gideon Lee, on the stand, and what does he say? We use the general term fish to comprehend them all. I mean we, plain men, carry on the substantial business of this great world, and however naturalists have made other distinctions and classifications for other purposes, we disregard them. Do not listen to this Mitchell turkey, right? Come to me, the dollar guys, the people who have the bucks know the answers. In the course of our common pursuits, we call all marine animals fish and all land animals quadrupeds. And the witness then laid on the table a parcel of letters, invoices, bills of lading, printed price currents from Liverpool, London, Bordeaux, Amsterdam, Baltimore, Boston, and New York, all of which agreed essentially with his testimony. Okay, so I won't give you the resolution of the trial, but I will say that science doesn't fare quite as nicely as you would hope. And that I promise I would conclude with a reflection on the arguments of this book. And I think what I'll say there is that the book wants to make a couple of claims. Probably the most important claim is a claim about the role of natural history in the emergence of the early republic, the emergence of the United States. We have a pretty extensive literature, a historical literature, that argues that taxonomy and systematics were extremely important to the kind of invocation of the United States in the early period. The United States was nature's nation. Right? We were a special kind of place because we had this wild hinterland, which distinguished us from our European forebears. And in that context, ideas about the study of nature, it has been argued, occupied an elevated place in American early national discourse. And part of what I'm able to show is that while it is indeed true that natural history played an essential role in the kind of articulation of the early American nation, that language of natural history was a very unstable language. Before this trial ends, natural history will be used to make some rather invidious distinctions between Knickerbockers and Yankees. It turns out that most of those oil merchants were folks who came from New England. It's a distinction now lost on us, right? We think of the Knicks and the Yankees as both being kind of New York teams, right? But not in the early 19th century. This was a Knickerbocker town, an old Dutch town. And where were the Yankees coming from? The Yankees were those long-boned, hard-driving, mercenary, sort of getting and spending type guys who were coming from Massachusetts, Vermont, New Hampshire. And so in the end, the big fight here between the Chandlers and the Tanners is a fight in part between old New York and New York. And it just so happens that those New Englanders have a tendency to call whales a special thing, not like fish, because they whale a lot up in Massachusetts. Whereas New Yorkers here, it's not our business. Here, Knickerbockers, here in a Knickerbocker town, which is where you're in court, I'll have you know, we call whales fish, I assure you. Okay? So it's to say that a kind of taxonomy of Americans turns out to be decisive for the resolution of this case in a way that is pretty ugly. And you can get a flavor for just how badly science fares. And this will be a last slide I'll show you. When Mitchell walks back across to the New York Institution, what you get behind him is a lot of mocking sounds. This is a pamphlet making fun of Mitchell's position, published shortly after the trial. When it is considered, writes this wag, that our waters abound with dolphins so inclined by nature to aid and succor us, and that the larger kinds of cetacean, that is, are only banished by our cruelty from our shores, and seeing it is well attested that their milk resembles that of cows, with the addition of cream, see the Cyclopedia article Cetology, would it not be worthy the wisdom of our statistical, agricultural, and economical societies, think here New York Institution, to turn their attention to this weighty consideration, whether these creatures might not by good treatment be induced to lend us their aid to the navigation of our waters and to furnish us in return for our hospitality with abundance of nutrition. Moreover, there is no reason why judges and lawyers, legislatures and politicians, office hunters and lobby members may not, before many years, in their attendance upon terms, enjoy the advantages of conveyances upon a whale's back, infinitely surpassing the speed of the steamboat, newly invented, right, by Fulton, right, in these years, and, of course, Mitchell, huge champion of the steamboat, a man of the future, and that the shores of the Wallabout may resound with the music which calls the dolphins to be milked, be studded with the villas where citizens shall repair to enjoy country air and dolphins' way. The Bay of Gowanus seems designed by nature for the reception of whales. From them will be derived a rich supply of butter and cheese for home consumption and foreign commerce. So I hope you guys get the feel that this is a total send-up of the kind of mammal whale, right, the breasted whale, which New Yorkers have a time teasing Mitchell about for almost 15 years to come. So science takes a couple of kicks in the jaw in the mayor's court in 1818 with implications for the way American democracy evolves with respect to expert knowledge. And that's, again, one of the kind of larger take-home arguments of the book. So with that, I'll stop and would love to hear questions or thoughts that come from the room. Thank you. How are we doing on time, Roger? Do we have
Mark, what are we allowed here?
A few minutes. Excellent. Good. thoughts, questions?
For the purpose of the tanners, was whale oil just as good as fish oil? And was that, therefore, was that certification actually meaningful to them in either case of the barrels?
Right. A good kind of like down and dirty question. Like, what's it to
other than the tax tax on it.
Right. Nice. So basically, there's a lot of dispute about this. How much did tanners use whale oil is the question, in effect, right? And if they used a lot of fish oil, did it matter that that whale oil should also be infected? The answer to this question is very difficult to recover because craftsmen don't leave especially great recipes for their secret sauce, right? And this is a basic problem for doing this kind of history. But I spent a lot of time with the only available sets of kind of handbooks for tanners at this time. And it is pretty clear that in the event that they can't get liver oil, fish oil that is, they will use whale oil. So, and folks say this on the stand. They say back during the War of 1812, when American fisheries were substantially cut off and we couldn't get fish oil anymore, we were using backstock of whale oil all the time in the tanneries. But they're chary about saying exactly how much they're doing that, really, because, again, none of them want to give away trade secrets for how they make their incredibly soft, supple leather, A. And B, in my view, and this is perhaps more to the point, Gideon Lee really wants to stick it to this community of handlers, of merchants, in effect. And so it ends up being really a kind of if you'll excuse me, but in the sense that he got this law passed, and now he wants to show that his faction has the power to prop that law up and protect it from any kinds of assault. So that's the sort of highest level answer to the question. I get more excited than I suspect any of you would want to get about like the minutiae of this oil stuff as a result of having done this research. And I promise you I do like work on other stuff. Like, you may think as a result of this talk that I'm just a deranged lunatic who lives in the world of, you know, 1805 to 1825 or something, but it's not true. I teach other kinds of courses in the future of a book. You do this kind of work for a book. But with that as an apology, I'll note that fish oil, the stuff that was being inspected here, was really liver oil, by which this meant you catch a bunch of ground fish, mostly cod, sometimes dogfish, little sharks, and basically anything else that comes up out of the trawl net. You rip out their livers, you throw the livers in a barrel, and you leave them in the sun. And what drips out of the bottom of that keg is an extremely nasty oil, which is what we now call cod liver oil, although not purified, just raw, icky. Whale oils are all tried oils, in the sense that they are basically tallows. They are melted fat that is cooked out over a fire. So when the merchants get up there and the craftsmen get up there, they're like, look, there's all the difference in the world between these two products. You need inspections for fish oil because it comes to market with water, blood, scum, all kinds of horrible stuff in it because it's just leached out and then, you know, they put a bung in the top of the barrel and sell it. It's horrible stuff. Whale oils are cooked at, you know, hundreds and hundreds of degrees and boiled. And if you put even this much water in such conflagration of oils, the whole thing would explode. You've probably done this at home. You put in a little olive oil, you put like, you know, the spinach in, it's wet, it goes up in your face. The guys who are accustomed to doing this kind of work say it could never happen that a barrel of oil would come to market with water or other kinds of crap in it. It's pointless to inspect this stuff. It always comes to market clean because it's a tried oil. It's a tallow. So in that sense, Lee is sort of, he's just being a pain, really, sticking up for his law, because my own reading of the situation is that the Chandlers are basically right, that it doesn't make sense to have the spermaceti oils come under the inspection designation. But for those of you who are really hardcore, I'll make one additional tiny point, which is when Judd and his buddies try to say, look, by fish oil, what's meant is liver oil, Lee and his buddies come right back at him and say, oh yeah? Well, what about Manhattan oil? So what's Manhattan? Any fly fishermen here with their places on the Cape? Manhattan is a small bait fish, about 4 inches long, which fly fishermen know well because the basic lure for catching stripers and bluefish on the northeastern coast in the spring and summer is a Manhattan fly, a fly that looks like a Manhattan, because Manhattan are the basic bait fish that are consumed by those fish on this coast. There was an enormous fishery which seined Manhattan and pressed them for oil. Not their livers, though, because they're really tiny. You'd have to do like microsurgery to get their livers out. So basically, you just put all the Manhattan in like an apple press to make, you know, like you use for making cider, and you just go, and like what comes out is sort of an oily scum. But this is used by the tanners to be like, not so fast. It's not the case that all fish oil is liver oil, because Manhattan oil is definitely a fish oil, but it doesn't come from the livers, it comes from the whole bodies. Gotcha there, fingers crossed. So this is the level of sort of stuff that you have to get into, not to enjoy the book. This stuff is in the footnotes. Other questions, yes?
Was fish oil used for anything else?
Yeah, a good question. What else was fish oil used for? Not much, actually. It turns out that the vast majority of fish oil was being sucked up by guys like Gideon Lee, who were trying to like take the tanning craft up to like industrial scale. And that's, again, part of the story. He's really going for vertical integration at this point because he's building tanneries that are so huge that they're basically acquiring the entire extant stocks of the basic raw products in order to corner the market. So people did use it for lubricants. It was used in making oil cloths. So if you wanted, you know, now some of you may own Barbour waxed cotton reindeer, which is all the rage, you know, in the horsey set in England. It's like what people did before they had Gore-Tex. You take a cotton, a tight woven cotton, and you treat it with a mixture of oils and waxes to make it impermeable to water. This was the only thing people had for slicks at that time, because you're before people's ability to use rubber. Rubber is a tropical product, as you know. It's found in by tapping trees. Those trees are not substantially tapped until the 1860s and 1870s. And anyway, until the balkanization process is developed, rubber is incredibly disgusting. It feels like an old banana after a couple of weeks. So if you made a rubberized coat, it would be like wearing an old banana after a couple of weeks before the balkanization started. So people use fish oils for making rain slicks, but in combination with waxes and that kind of stuff. And nobody ate it. It was not something that people ate for a vitamin supplement. Yes?
When
is
sperm oil used for white?
Absolutely. Spermaceti oil was the primary use of spermaceti in this time, was in the production of candles. Those spermacetis as liquid waxes could also be burned in lamps. Again, if you really love going down and dirty on this, spermaceti oil is not an oil, it's a wax, for starters. And it is different from ordinary whale oil. Ordinary whale oil is what happens if you take a right whale, you kill it, you strip its body fat off, and you melt that down. And that is a product that is basically indistinguishable from tallow, from lard. And people also burned that. There were tallow candles, there were tallow lamps. They smell kind of yucky because it's burning fat, but the poorer classes used those fats in their lamps and as candles. Spermaceti, if any of you have ever, would there be a way that you would have experienced spermaceti? I mean, basically, no. Spermaceti, you've had a chance to see a spermaceti candle? Or? Yeah, I'm not, that's interesting. I wonder whether they're probably getting it from the Soviets who are the last people. Leftover. Right, because of course it's been illegal to kill sperm whales since 1987. But except if you're in Norwegian or from Iceland. But basically, spermaceti is a very light wax, not a body fat. And sperm whales have it in a case in their heads. And it's actually used as part of their navigational systems. So it comes from here. The case and what's called the junk. So it's the most ritzy and expensive and fancy of the oils that could be gotten from a whale. And this is also part of the argument that the guys make. They're like, it's insane to treat it like it's fish oil. This is like a premier product here. And it's like, you know, if there was an inspection statute on frozen shrimp, and you're making it apply to, like, you know, beluga caviar that's been flown over in, you know, the personal keeping of a czar for the purpose of his private consumption. They're just totally, totally different things. And for those of you who like more Melville, I'm a Melville lover. If you've ever tried the Confidence Man, which is Melville's sort of late and spectacularly failed novella about American fraud, one of the richest passages in the Confidence Man is the story of China Astor, a candle maker who invests in some spermaceti oil in the effort to increase his business, so a luxury business model, by selling ritzier candles, and is subsequently economically ruined because of that maneuver, possibly a parable for our times. Go ahead.
So would you say then that the Tweed Courthouse, where Mitchell used to hang out, was the fitting architectural habitat for the city of the League of Plans and Bands somehow?
Yeah.
For a connection?
Yeah, what a nice image. I mean, kind of metaphorically speaking, I think that is lovely. It's a nice image. Part of what does happen, you know, concretely in this story, is that Mitchell's rather ugly reception by the Democratic Agon here sends him back over here to an institution that has not just taken it on the nose in this episode, but has taken it sufficiently hard on the nose in this episode that it'll actually be closed down a few years later. And I mean, it's a bit strong to try. There's a lot of stuff that puts paid to the New York institution, including an economic panic in 1819 and a lot of other stuff. So it wouldn't be quite fair to say Maurice V. Judd does in the New York Institution, but it wouldn't be entirely unfair to say that either, because it is a sort of, there's this delicate moment where the United States, I argue, could kind of go a different way in imagining the relationship between expert knowledge and democratic politics, and this case spells the death of that philosophical vision for New York and for the Republic as a whole. So this institution will be closed down and kind of sold off as offices. New Yorkers will ask, why the heck are we using taxpayer money to support a bunch of well-to-do patrician gentlemen so that they can sit around and muss about with shells and bones and this kind of stuff? Not a good use of taxpayer money. Yes?
When was the sign
So the question is, when was the scientific question settled? And you know, historians of science love a question like that. It depends on who you ask. You know, I mean, for plenty of people, it was well settled by 1818. If you had asked the majority of sort of, how to put it, I mean, I was going to say professional naturalists, except those of you who are the kind of historical thinkers in the room would have immediately raised a flag, because there is no such thing as a professional naturalist at this time, right? You can't get a salary to be a naturalist. That natural history is not really taught in schools, like Oxford and Cambridge don't have professors in natural history. They have some folks who do materia medica and that sort of thing in a kind of medical teaching environment. But nevertheless, if you ask the majority of people who were kind of sufficiently well-to-do that they spent their lives writing books about natural history in this period, most of them would have argued that they understood perfectly well that whales were well-categorized closer to quadrupeds, the traditional categories of quadrupeds, than more distant. But people had very different ideas about how to do that. Linnaeus himself, through the first 9 editions of the System of Nature, put whales in fish. And when he moved them out of fish and put them in mammals, one of his rivals wrote a furious attack, pointing out that he himself, Linnaeus's rival, had moved the larger category of the sea bears, which contained whales but also included manatees and walruses, okay, the plagiures, the bears of the sea. He had already moved that category out of the fish category and set it up at its own rank at the same level as fish and mammal. And so what does he say? He says this turkey Linnaeus has put it under mammals just to try to prove that he's not plagiarizing from me. Because I'm the guy who figured out in 1756 that all those creatures didn't belong in fish anymore, and now comes along Linnaeus claiming my discovery as his own and setting it up in this idiotic way by actually putting them under the category of mammals where they don't belong, I'll have you know. But so even with those kinds of disputes going on into the later part of the 18th century, it is a case that most naturalists would have agreed on this by the beginning of the 19th century. And in fact, as for Darwin, Darwin was at a society dinner in about 1824, a little bit before that, right? Before he leaves on the Beagle Voyage. And there's a kind of loudmouthed society physician who thinks of himself as something of a know-it-all, who declares en passant in the course of the dinner that whales are fish. And in a letter to one of his friends that he writes that night, Darwin's like, what an idiot that guy, huh? I mean, saying that whales are fish. So it was obvious to Darwin, well before his evolutionary theory, that no kind of serious person who was in the know would say such a dumb thing, although a person emphatically in the know, ostensibly, kind of very, very well put together physician who could travel in the best circles, could in fact say that in the 1820s, and nobody would call him out.
That was in Europe.
What about in the United States? That's interesting.
Fixing with the abolitionist argument of 1933,
yeah.
Right. Institute, especially with that photograph.
Interesting. Very interesting. My assumption is that certainly by the time that Joseph Henry is sort of making the Smithsonian run, nobody there would have put a whale specimen under a miscellaneous category. It would have been whacked right there under the normal. I mean, the U.S. Exploring Expedition, which does its round the world tour 1838 to 42, none of those naturalists would have argued that a whale was anything but a mammal by that point. So, again, in expert circles, everyone would have agreed on that. And indeed, by the end of the 19th century, whales become a very important example for the evolutionists. Remember, they get cited in the Scopes trial as one of the kind of best evolutionary stories we have because they are so clearly, once upon a time, a land creature. As many of you probably know, sperm whales, in fact, do have vestigial hind legs, quadruped. They have vestigial hind legs. They're, you know, about that long, and they're entirely buried inside the body. And I've only seen one beach sperm whale, and it was sufficiently old and disgusting on a beach in Mexico that I wasn't prepared to do the work of digging in and looking for it, but there are these two little dingles that they have back there and a vestigial pelvis. We should probably wrap pretty soon, but yes, right?
I'm hoping to ask the last question.
Yes.
Would you like to say anything about your next book?
Oh, that's so sweet. This book actually was kind of snipped out of a larger book. And that larger book was going to look at whales from monsters in the early modern period, wonders, to soulful, musical, friends of humanity, bellwethers of human environmentally responsibility, totems of the counterculture, like Think Whales 1972. And in the end, that was just going to be too big a book. So this got cut out as sort of the first half of that book, and it does handle a lot of that terrain, the kind of wonders to emergence of taxonomic systems of the Darwin period. And the rest of the book, it's hard to say when exactly I'll have it done, but I've promised it to the publishers by the middle of this summer. And it looks basically at the emergence of the Save the Whales campaign in the 20th century. So it's about the role that scientists play in making us aware of the perils that these animals were facing as a result of the industrial whale fishery of the 20th century. Not this open boat, throwing harpoons kind of stuff, which really, people argue about this, but in my view, it didn't really do much damage to populations. There are very still serious arguments about the impact of the 19th century whaling industry on whale stocks, but I'm on the camp that says it didn't really do that much damage. What did do damage was when somebody figured out how to make an explosive grenade in the head of a cannon-fired harpoon attached to a line, and then apropos of the fact that blue whales and fin whales sink after you kill them, if you can believe it, figured out how to drive a compressed air dart into the animal to inflate their body cavities to keep them afloat long enough to be able to bring them aboard factory vessels. That combination of stuff doesn't really happen until the beginning of the 20th century. And it is that industrial whale fishery which nearly wipes out most of the world's major cetacean population. And a last thing I'll leave you with, which is just a weird fact that you otherwise won't know probably, is that that industry was not for oils for illumination. Right? Nobody was using lamps, right, with oil in them in the 1950s. So what the hell were they killing all those whales for? Does anybody know?
Corsets.
What, say again?
Corsets.
Corsets, right. Corsets. Corsets, again, is the 19th century industry. You could have made a lot of corsets with 2.4 million cetaceans. Say again? Dog food's a great answer, and that is a big chunk of the byproduct of the industry. So the industry is not interested in the meat, but eventually they figure out they can make some change by selling the leftover meat as dog food additives and fertilizer additives. But that's a secondary market. The primary market is the oil, and what are they doing with the fat? What are they doing with the fat? Saponification is also a part of the industry, but it is not the highest budget factor in the industry. Probably about 30% of the revenue comes from saponification of the second-rate fats, the blasted fats, the nasty fats. The majority of that fat goes to human consumption in the form of margarine. margarine is margarine in the United States has almost never been made from any serious fraction of whale oil, but that is only because of the extraordinary lobbying power both of the American dairy industry, which was very defensive about margarine from the beginning, and the American agricultural lobby, which much preferred for corn oils to be used in those products because that was a native product that they could control, and since they've essentially run the Congress for most of the 20th century, they would have been able to keep whale oil out. But in continental Europe, and especially in Britain, the primary ingredient in the margarines sold in Europe between 1928 and 1965 was whale oil. Pretty nasty. There you go. Thank you very much.
We do have books for sale, and he'll be willing to sign them if you'd like to come to the front.